This is a special edition of Dateline Washington. I'm Greg Corumbus. Thanks for spending part of your Christmas with us. We now continue our special look at the history and traditions of Christmas. Here again is Sarah Bunbronick.
During the Christian season of Advent, which is the 4 weeks preceding Christmas, comes the Jewish festival of lights known as Hanukkah. Hanukkah is an eight-day celebration which marks the first recorded battle for religious freedom. In 164 BC, Judas Maccabee and a small band of followers waged a battle to reclaim the Jerusalem temple. After they were victorious, they rededicated the temple, but there was only enough sacred oil to last for 1 day. Miraculously, this 1 day supply lasted for 8 until more could arrive.
I am Rabbi Jeffrey Wahlberg of Addis Israel Congregation in Washington, D.C. Hanukkah is not the Jewish Christmas, and to compare the two is really to misunderstand both. Hanukkah celebrates the first rebellion for religious freedom in history. In a world which cherishes freedom, that is exceedingly important. Hanukkah is a minor festival because it happened after the Bible was completed. But had it happened earlier, had the Bible been completed later, it certainly would have been included because it focuses on major themes. Its essence is heritage and values and tradition. The Maccabees stood up for what they believed in and fought for the right to practice their tradition and their heritage. That is exceedingly precious. Although a small number, they dared to oppose the majority. They dared to light the lights of Hanukkah, and they remained for us a model and an example.
It was close to Christmas in 1822, and the Reverend Clement Clark Moore, a professor at New York's General Theological Seminary, was driving home in his sleigh on a snowy evening. As he listened to the sleigh bells on his own horse, he began composing a poem to amuse his children on Christmas Eve.
"'Twas the night before Christmas, and, let me see, all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. That's it. Not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap."
No doubt the Reverend Moore, a serious scholar, would have preferred to be remembered for his Hebrew translations of the Bible rather than as the man who created Santa Claus. But this is no small legacy.
"His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself."
For years later, after Moore's poem was initially published, artists tried, always unsuccessfully, to capture a picture of Santa Claus as resonant as Moore's description. It wasn't until some 40 years later when Harper's Weekly illustrator Thomas Nast, then famous for his caricatures of political bosses and politicians, began to draw Moore's St. Nick that the definitive image of a large, jovial, white-bearded man in a red suit with white fur trimmings seized the Victorian imagination and entered into our national consciousness. Thomas Nast also popularized and made official some of Santa's activities, such as manufacturing toys in his North Pole workshop, keeping records of good and naughty children in his big black book, and receiving and answering their mail. St. Nicholas, Father Christmas, Kris Kringle, Père Noël. The benevolent Christmas gift giver was known by all of these names, as the Dutch, German, English, and French traditions blended into the American Victorian Santa Claus. Each December, millions of American children sit down to compose long, serious letters detailing their behavior during the past year and what they would like as rewards for having been so good. Most of these letters are addressed to Santa Claus, care of the North Pole. Some just say Santa Claus. Now, usually the U.S. Postal Service requires very specific complete addresses, down to 9-digit zip codes. But in Santa's case, they make an exception. Still, the responsibility of getting all those hopes and dreams and wishes of America's children to Santa Claus must be an awesome responsibility.
I'm George Conrad with the United States Postal Service. At this time of the year, the mail begins to pick up for Christmas. We receive and deliver about 1 billion more pieces of mail than we would during a normal 3 or 4 week period during the year. Many of those extra pieces are Christmas cards that people are sending one another, and a lot of them are letters from children to Santa Claus. Post offices throughout the United States make sure that volunteers are available who can help Santa Claus answer the letters. And the Postal Service makes sure all the letters get through to Santa Claus at the North Pole, so Santa can give the children what they ask for. I guess the proof is in what ends up in the stocking or under the tree.
When we come back, some final thoughts. Please stay with us.